So we've been following the stories of David for the last two or three months here. And some of you are going to be really excited to hear that this is the last week of following the stories of David. Some of you might be disappointed to hear. We'll do some thinking about it next week together. But this is the last of telling the stories. And just to note that this week coming in, this is just sort of a side thing. At the end of the whole episode last week of Bathsheba and Uriah and Nathan coming and all the things that happened there, the Israelites are going back to war again at the end of that chapter, and David goes this time. So David's kind of got his act back together. He's doing what he's supposed to be doing as king. He's being more faithful. And then we hit this next narrative, and we're telling a lot today. There's a lot of information as far as the story. Let me explain. No, there's too much. Let me sum up. So this is kind of one of the longest kind of contiguous narratives that happens in all of the David stories, that we start with David's son Amnon, who is got it bad for his sister Tamar, and she's not interested, and this whole thing goes terribly wrong and sideways, and Amnon ends up raping Tamar, and Absalom, who's Tamar's full brother, decides that Amnon should die and goes around and kills him, and that's how we get there. There's a lot going on. David's parenting is probably not the best parenting. David says nothing about this to any of them all the way through this chapter. And this launches this whole next thing. So we have this system of violence and this system of inappropriate behavior and the system of lack of accountability that starts right here with Amnon and Absalom. So Absalom, after killing his brother, has been hiding out from David. And Joab, if you'll remember Joab, he's the commander of David's army. He was the guy who put Uriah in trouble, right? So Joab's kind of a seedy guy. He comes back to try to get Absalom reinstated into David's good graces, and he succeeds. This is sort of a medieval painting of it. He gets a woman to come to David and say, "Hey, here's a parable. Here's this thing, this guy does this thing, and you know, how should you feel about this?" And it really echoes what Nathan does with David. If you'll remember that story where Nathan tells David the story and David's like, "This is how it is." This time David's like, "So tell me, honestly, to the woman, is Joab behind this? Like, was this Joab's idea?" Yeah, this was Joab's idea. But it still works out. So Absalom and David are back together in like a good relationship of sorts. And then Absalom starts kind of feeling out his power. Absalom starts acting in the ways that he wants to act. One of the things that's kind of an interesting piece of Absalom's time here is he really wants to talk to Joab, and Joab says, "No, I don't want to talk to you." And Absalom says, "No, I want to talk to you." And Joab says, "No, I don't want to talk to you." And Absalom says, "Fine, I'm going to set your field on fire." And Joab goes, "Okay, I'll come talk to you now that you've set my field on fire." This factors in later. So Absalom is a good-looking guy. The scripture is really clear that Absalom's kind of a hairy beast. That's sort of a paraphrase. And he starts to feel like maybe he should be the next king. So Absalom starts to do things that start kind of winning. You know, the scripture actually says Absalom steals the hearts of the people. He wants to be the next guy. He sits out in front of the gate and sort of like, instead of people getting into David to get judgment done, Absalom says, no, I'll take care of that. It's cool. I got it. Right? So Absalom keeps on kind of pushing into this role of taking more and more power on, and David's not doing anything about it. Eventually, Absalom decides to make this a full-on rebellion and try to take over the kingdom, and is basically chasing David around the countryside. And then Absalom's beautiful hair, which he got cut once a year when it got too heavy, three pounds of hair, gets caught in a tree as he's running away. And it happens to be Joab who's there when this happens. And Joab thinks, in Joab's sort of transparent way, "This guy burned down my field. I think I'll kill him." And so Absalom dies to David's consternation. And this story keeps on going on. So if you want to check out the story, there's a lot more there than what I've told you. This is just like the very basic plot outline. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of interesting things happening relationally and dynamically. But basically, David's kingdom is at stake for the entire second half of 2 Samuel and into 1 Kings. At the beginning of 1 Kings, you have Adonijah, another son of David, who is trying to make himself king. And Bathsheba and Nathan the prophet and a couple people get together and go, David, you remember you said Solomon gets to be king. You made this promise. And he goes, oh yeah, that's right. And Solomon is crowned king instead of Adonijah. And one of the funniest parts of this story is there's a whole group of people who are at a banquet at Adonijah's place going, hey, he's king. And messengers show up and go, Solomon just got crowned king. And it says they all left quickly, which is about right. So this is a mess that's going on in Israel right now. And it's all following on the heels of David's action with Bathsheba and Uriah. And this is exactly what Nathan the prophet says God has said the consequence will be. So just to remind us, therefore the sword shall never depart from your house, for you have despised me. I will raise up trouble against you from within your own house, and I will take your wives before your eyes. And now, all of this has happened in this narrative. So what do we make of that? How is God speaking to us through these stories? And I think there's a couple things that are worth pausing to remember before we get to application. And one is that Scripture is not always a how-to account of how to get it right or how to do it. These parts of the Old Testament are not instructional letters like Paul writes in the epistles, but a narrative of what actually happened. And for the most part, in these scriptures, it doesn't actually pass judgment on what happens. It just reports, like, here's what went down. They leave the interpretation up to the reader. But we should also know that Scripture's not letting people off the hook here. This is not a get-out-of-jail-free card. Tamar's rape is not okay. Amnon's murder, Absalom's death, Joab's action. None of these things gets a seal of approval. This is a story about how things went wrong. It's the kingdom falling apart on David. It's a story about abuse of power that was modeled by the abuse of power by David. David becomes a model for his children, and that includes violence and abuse of power. And it may feel like David gets a free pass here with his reputation for being, quote, a man after God's own heart, but this narrative paints a bleak picture, telling a vivid story of the fallout of David's lack of faithfulness and the consequences to everybody around him. I think it's also important that we place this in a bigger context. So what's happening here in the scriptural narrative is a different picture when you look at it more broadly. So the narrative of David's kingship is viewed through Moses' covenant and through the Mosaic law. It's in the context of Israel asking for a king and God relenting, but also warning that kings will be after their own self-interest at the expense of the people. The story is also in the context of Saul's consistent unfaithfulness and David's relatively consistent faithfulness up to this point. So maybe through some of these lenses, we can see more clearly what Scripture might be saying. And there's some easy ones here. The consequences of not being faithful are obvious. Sin, brokenness in relationship with God, is not just a spiritual scoreboard, but action that creates real problems and real consequences. God calls us to faithfulness not only for right relationship with God, but for right relationship between each other and right action and relationship with society. Things may have been made right with David and God when David repents, but David's actions now have made way for others to feel licensed to act in harmful ways to themselves and others. And one of the theological questions that this raises is, what's God's role in this? When God tells David the consequence of his action, does God cause these things to happen or name that they're going to happen? And on one hand, it doesn't really matter that much. I mean, David's encountering the same consequences to his action. He's facing these realities. And either way, in our own context, we face the consequences of our lack of faithfulness. On the other hand, it matters a lot. If the nature of God is to be vindictive, to cause rape and murder and rebellion to come about as means of punishment or a premeditated consequence, that's a very different character of God than a God who can see the repercussions of people's chosen action. And the story itself doesn't exactly weigh in on this, although the author often, and Samuel, does credit God with direct action at other times. God is credited with sending an evil spirit against Saul. And God is given direct credit for causality in other places of this story, but not here. Amnon isn't moved to lust after his sister by the Spirit of God. Absalom isn't moved to vengeful murder or to try and take the kingdom from his father by some note that God prompts. It seems clear that the author isn't afraid to assign responsibility. It seems that Amnon, Absalom, Joab, and others had plenty of their own motivation to shape this story. They didn't need to be motivated by God to bring about the consequences God had warned of. The environment and culture that David creates and his choice to pursue his own ends is enough to bring out the lust for power and violence that leads to Amnon's violence against his sister and Absalom's vengeance and rebellion and Joab's willingness to kill. And when we put God to this kind of theological scrutiny, we would do well to remember the bigger picture. God has been busy orchestrating the life of Israel and giving commandments like this in Deuteronomy 6. Do what is right and good in the sight of the Lord so it may go well with you. The Lord commanded us to observe all these statutes to fear the Lord our God for our lasting good. God's intention is not a power play to enforce obedience, but a way of being that is for the good of God's people. Our desire to put the blame on a vindictive God is a means of directing responsibility away from ourselves. And there's an ongoing struggle in all of these stories, and that's the question of who is in charge. Is it us? Is it me? Is it God? And early in David's life, even early in David's kingship, David is relatively consistent to live a God-directed life, to be dependent on God's direct guidance. But starting with his choices around Bathsheba and Uriah, David begins to veer away from faithfulness. Saul's break in relationship with God and eventual failure begins as a lack of faithfulness. And unlike Saul, David moves back towards dependent relationship with God through these stories. And that seems to be a bit of an anomaly with folks in power. I think one of the things that's clear in these stories, though, is that the systems of power work against faithfulness. Systemic power leads to entitlement, to violence, to self-centered action. Whether it's Amnon's sense of entitlement to possess a woman he wanted, or Absalom's entitlement to revenge and then to the throne, or Adonijah's sense of entitlement to the throne as well, or Joab as commander of the army seems to kill folks with impunity. The more these folks find there aren't boundaries to their actions and that the system of privilege they function under isn't going to provide accountability, the further they're willing to go to satisfy their own desires. I think systemic power robs us of who we really are, who we're really called to be, and it blinds us to the realities of those around us. We no longer believe in dependency or community. We no longer worship or depend on God, because we begin to worship our own security and believe that we have no need for trust or dependence on God or on others. It sounds a bit like the temptation in the Garden of Eden, doesn't it? We seek for immortality and for the fullness of the knowledge of good and evil so that we can be self-sufficient rather than trusting God for what we need. Now, without a doubt, David gets pulled into all of this. He abuses his power with Bathsheba, and he continues to get sucked into the system by the actions of his kids. And even in the end, when he's giving good advice to Solomon, he's still drawn towards systemic power, still concerned about his own language, his own legacy. He gives this advice to Solomon as he's dying. "I'm about to go the way of all the earth, so be strong, be courageous, and keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his statutes, his commandments, his ordinances, and his testimonies, as it is written in the law of Moses, so that you may prosper in all that you do and wherever you turn." And that seems like pretty solid, straightforward advice. But David doesn't end there as he's talking to Solomon. So do this so that the Lord will establish his word that he spoke concerning me. If your heirs take heed to their way, to walk before me in faithfulness with all their heart and with all their soul, there shall not fail you a successor on the throne of Israel. Which is as much for David's own legacy as it is for Solomon's. And David doesn't stop there. He goes on to imply that Solomon should kill Joab and another guy named Shimei. It's clear that the systems of power are at work here. Revenge, entitlement, violence, self-preservation, legacy. And it's ironic that David implores Solomon to, quote, keep the charge of the Lord your God, walking in his ways and keeping his laws. And in the next sentence or two, encourages Solomon to break many of those same charges and laws. So life is messy, right? Life is complicated and scary, and like we said last week, it's easier to categorize and compartmentalize than it is to look at the whole big picture. And David's life is like that. Which David do you want to see? How much are we willing to acknowledge that nobody, not even our own biblical heroes, if we're honest, live utterly faultless lives? I think we'd like to have our heroes be perfect, without flaw or difficulty. And maybe that's because it's easier to have something to aspire to that looks perfect. But I think maybe, too, because we don't want to have to deal with that mess. We don't want to have to sort through the mix of beauty and ugliness, of trust and self-satisfaction, of faithfulness and disobedience, because we see it in ourselves and don't want to mess with it there either. And maybe we don't want to have to deal with the mess it makes to have a God who doesn't seem to be primarily interested in us getting it right, but rather is interested in us being right with God. In all of this, God is exasperatingly full of grace. These folks should be condemned. They should face the consequences of an angry God. People shouldn't be able to do things like rape and murder and scheme, but they do. And often it seems like God forgives them. It's frustrating. Where's the justice? Or maybe, where's our humility and where's our trust in God? I heard someone say the other day that they didn't confess their sins to God, but instead they simply tried to do better the next time. And it hit me that this may be at the heart of what it means to not be faithful. Rather than choosing dependency and trust on God, this attitude chooses the opposite. This way of thinking assumes in arrogance what better would mean, and that in our own power we are capable of rectifying our relationship with God and of making the world right through our own directed action. I'll bring Israel to a better place than my dad can. We see it with Joab. I'll decide who gets to live or die. I think we see it in our own lives because it's a temptation of self-reliance. It's been part of the core temptation of humans in all of our recorded history. If we stop and consider, do we really believe we have the perspective and means to set things right? Can we make relationship with each other or with God right without the humility to acknowledge that we've not gotten it right? Say what we will about David. Can bring up his failings and his passion that gets him in trouble, his falling for the temptation of power. But he gets it when it comes to grace. Cast me not away from your presence, he prays. Renew a right spirit within me. David is a person after God's own heart, not because he has the same heart as God, but after God's own heart in the sense of following in God's way. After as in pursuit of God. In pursuit of collaboration and unity with what God is up to. And today we face the same temptation of systems of power and entitlement, of privilege and the violence that comes from it. We too face the temptation to just do better, to just help others do it better too, to fix it by our own means and insight, not to ask for direction. But can we step back even in the midst of our own mess and mistakes, and ask to be renewed with right spirits, to be a people who are after God's own heart. So let's take some time to listen. There'll be some questions up on the screen if they're helpful. Use them. If not, don't. And maybe Christ has a message for just you today, or maybe through you for a couple other people, and we ask you to be faithful to that. If Christ has a message through you for all of us, we ask that you'd stand and wait, and a microphone will be brought so we can all hear that well. Let's listen together.